This is the Takeaway Podcast for Thursday, July 23rd, 2015. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. President Obama heads to Africa this week, making his first trip as president to his father's homeland of Kenya and then on to Ethiopia. When President Obama first took office, he was a global symbol and he spoke like a poet and a statesman. He spoke of turning the pages to history in Africa. As the first American black president and son of a Kenyan, that would be transformational for the continent. And there were some echoes of that old idealistic Obama at a reception yesterday marking the signing of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which was first authorized in 2000.
Africa is a place of incredible dynamism, some of the fastest growing markets in the world, extraordinary people, extraordinary resilience, and it has the potential to be the next center of global economic growth.
But you can hear it there. It is also a more tempered and pragmatic Barack Obama who returns to Africa this week. An Obama who knows the difficulty of making change versus the ease of promising change. He's lived the contradictions in U.S. policy in Africa, calling for peace and democracy while supplying weapons to the military dictators in Egypt and a continued military presence in Somalia. Promises of electricity to 20 million Africans still unfulfilled. The United States and the West love to set lofty goals for Africa. There are the United Nations Millennium Development Goals to improve poverty, education, gender equality, child mortality, 21 targets. This more pragmatic Obama will be hearing from a stronger and more skeptical set of voices in Africa this time. People like the three African writers who we spoke to this spring as part of the New York Penn World Voices Festival. Adewale Adaje is a Nigerian-born lawyer and playwright. Alain Mbanku is a French citizen born in the Republic of the Congo. And Yvonne Adhiambo Uwor is a Kenyan writer and author of the novel Dust. Yvonne from Kenya says she's tired of the platitudes from the well-meaning West.
Quite frankly, I think the first question is, what is democracy? I'm sure the models that have been perpetuated and propagated all over the world, I think people are a bit nervous about calling the emperor naked. Coming from Nairobi, where it's quite fascinating to see the whole world land and everybody trying to acquire a little stake in a different corner of the country, it obviously means that there's something amazing happening and there's something that the world desperately wants, actually desperately craves. But the responsibility, and quite frankly, my whole thing is, as an African people, we need to look within. We need to decide what it is that we actually do want for ourselves with our assets.
Well, let's talk about the mechanism for Kenyans answering that question you just posed. Mm-hmm. How do Kenyans figure out what it is they want as a government, as a political model? Certainly the Western models and, you know, American models of democracy are utterly discredited in this century so far.
I think you'd be speaking to a deep dream, one of those dreams that dare not speak out. We'd have to have the courage to look within. We'd have to have the courage to stop a while and ask ourselves, you know, eye to eye, and literally look into each other's eyes and say, but what do we want? Who are we? What future do we dare to dream for ourselves? We're always rushing to do this and rushing to do that and picking up this ideology and trying that method and having a coup d'etat, that kind of thing. But there's never been a moment of just stopping and asking, who are we? What do we want? What does our future look like, smell like, taste like? With what we have.
Can the three of you have a conversation like that, given the very different perspectives that you have on the continent, Nigerian, Kenyan, and from Congo? Is there a way that three writers could do exactly what you just suggested right there, Yvonne?
We could, actually. Maybe that's a challenge. We could, but we don't do it.
Well, go for it. Adewale, what do you want to say? What do you want in terms of a political future?
Well, I'm very much like Yvonne, that people should live for their dreams, not their nightmares. And I don't want to be defined by what I'm against. I want to be defined by what I'm for. Mm-hmm. And essentially, when I think about the African continent, what I want is a definition of African excellence. I want people to be able to have the debate, the discussion, to disagree, agree to disagree wherever possible. And the one thing that this generation of Africans have to give their children is the space and the ability to think and to recognize that God never made a counterfeit. that there is something original about the African like it is about any other group of people, and we should dare to start to think about what kind of world we want to create. There's so many things we can talk about in that context. The challenge of really learning from each other, the challenge of really defining the processes that work for us. One of the most definitive challenges of the African continent is how to collaborate effectively, how to organize. Organization is culturally determined. Usually we end up talking about poverty, but poverty of what? Poverty of material does not mean poverty of ideas. Poverty of material does not mean poverty of thought. It doesn't mean poverty of relationship. In my ethnic origin, the Yoruba people, we have about 30 words for wealth, and only one talks about money. You know, so actually framing life in such a way that money becomes a dominant thing, that we're constantly doing instant gratification. We borrow content that does not fit our context. And until we start to really be eclectic in what we bring in into the context of our dreams and our desires, we would always have the challenge of being a brand new second hand.
Alain, what would you add to this conversation?
I think that we need to get to know one another. For instance, when I meet a Senegalese, we cannot speak another language than the French. I need to learn Wolof. I need to learn Yoruba. I need to learn Kikuyu. I think that Africans ignore themselves because we have a lot of knowledges which came from the Western civilization, but so we don't pay attention to our own cultures, who are very diverse. And the next step is like to make a kind of inventory of our cultures in order to find what we can put together, which gonna build maybe the next Africa, that Africa which gonna take care also of the world as it is changing right now.
Well, there'll be some Americans listening to this conversation, and I'm sure they'll be fascinated, but they might say to themselves, well, gosh, here all these well-meaning folks in the West have come up with these Millennium Development Goals and created all of these laudable missions for what's going on in Africa and for making things better for people. And here are these three writers saying, we don't want much to do with it all. How would you respond to that?
Let's go back to the basics. It comes back to the fundamental thing. What does it mean to be human? And I don't mean that even in a philosophical sense. I don't know. The well-meaning, and as you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. You have to live in the continent to experience the inundation of all these parachuting, well-meaning types with the mission plan and a messianic vision for you who have not only spoken your entire world and vision, but have ensured that you have absolutely no space and place to speak, because actually the presumption is that you poor pathetic thing, you have absolutely no means of even understanding who you are in this place in life. And don't worry, we've taken care of it all. It's beyond hubristic. And I think my generation has, I think, reached a point of beyond irritation. There's a kind of like, just stop it. Really, just stop it. And let's now start again and let's try to be human. Everybody has their dreams. Everybody has a particular vision. Everybody has a longing. The questions that exercise somebody in Texas also exercises a person in my village in Kano. What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be human? What's the meaning of my life? And the meaning of my life are not these vague, wafty things called Millennium Development Goals or the idiotic idea of eradicating extreme hunger, or the reduction of the human being into sound bites, commoditized sound bites that look good on business plans or annual reports that absolutely nobody reads. I've reached a point of thinking, let's kind of come on, guys, let's get real. The world's in trouble. There are a lot of solutions everywhere. Let's talk human to human. There are things we need to do, and we need to do them very quickly. And let's stop the wafting and the waffling.
Just stop it.
Just stop
sounds
it,
like,
really.
Sounds like a great book title. I'd love to see that on a UN document. Just stop it.
Oh, dare we hope.
Yeah. Adewale, what do you think?
Well, I start from Baltimore. I start from Ferguson. and I start from the streets of New York, and I see how Africa gets treated here. So it's that. Firstly, what does Africa mean to people when people engage Africa? What do they do with the Africa in their own front garden, in their own street? And the second thing is I have a lot of people with what I'll call the European savior complex. Just as Yvonne was saying, okay, they're going to come and fix a problem. Well, if you really want to fix a problem, first you have to have a good understanding of what you see as a problem. I certainly think that we in the African continent need to be a bit more assertive about our dreams. I don't want to blame anybody. I don't want to, you know, I'm big, bad, and ugly enough to own my own problems and make it work. I have spent the past few months working on peace building in the Niger Delta. I find it really fascinating that people develop a sense of entitlement without a sense of involvement. And that is a state of orientation that comes from somebody coming in and telling you they will fix your problem and they own your problem. So it's not helpful. It can be destructive, but we have to start from the premise that Africans have to love themselves.
Alain?
Yes, I think also I don't want to be a kind of African who is like crying because he's suffering, he's doing that and that. I need to find my own solution. I don't want to be defined by the other. I don't want to be like this kind of African who is waiting for the help of the other people. Africa is now. Your destiny is in your own mind and in your own hands.
Well, Adewale, Yvonne, and Elaine, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Adewale Adaji is a Nigerian-born lawyer and playwright. Elaine Mbanku is a French citizen born in the Republic of the Congo. And Yvonne Adhiambo Awor is a Kenyan writer and author of the novel Dust. They joined us earlier this year while they were on a trip to New York City.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Curious.com, helping people grow skills in areas like programming and parenting. Broadcasting a live discussion on how to raise an adult this Thursday with author Julie Lithcott-Hames at 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
In the puzzling, frustrating, deeply tragic and unsettling case of Sandra Bland, it appears the psychological dimensions of being suddenly torn from her exciting new future, new job, in a new place, and instead thrown in jail were not well understood or anticipated by the officials in Waller County, Texas. Sandra Bland, found dead in a jail cell 3 days after an angry encounter with a seemingly overeager and intolerant arresting officer who brought her in after a traffic stop about a failure to use her turn signal. We have little more than a dashboard video of the arrest to go on, some video in the jail that shows she was left alone for 90 minutes with no observation, after which time she was found hanging. There are new details that she told jailers she once attempted suicide by taking pills because she said she had lost a baby. Now, The Takeaway has learned that the Texas Commission on Jail Standards was not happy with the record of the jail's compliance with codes designed to monitor mental health.
We did issue a notice of noncompliance based upon a records review of the Waller County Jail.
Brandon Wood is executive director of the Texas Commission, who cites two areas of concern.
The first one dealt with training in regards to ensuring that no less than 2 hours of training each year were provided to all jail staff by the local mental health authority. The second one dealt with face-to-face observation of inmates no less than once every 60 minutes.
These noncompliance notices are more alarming when you consider that mental health issues are a constant theme in the U.S. correction system. Not only that, did you know that suicide is the leading cause of death in the American prison system? Robert Canning is an expert on suicide prevention in jails and prisons and is a senior psychologist with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Americans, he says, don't widely understand how much being taken to jail can be devastating, regardless of the question of guilt or innocence, and the responsibility authorities have to focus on mental health.
Well, I think that prisons have become much more aware of it in the last 20 to 30 years as pressure has come on them to recognize the significant trauma that people experience when they've been arrested and when they're put in this position That people are separated from their families, they're some separated from their belongings. They are all of a sudden in a situation sometimes for some people that is completely foreign to them.
And in that case, you don't know what sort of mental issues they're bringing with them, the extent to which they are vulnerable. And the idea that suicide is a leading cause of death in the American prison system suddenly suggests that the prisons are exacerbating problems that were there before the arrest.
Well, I think what happens with jails in particular, where the problem is biggest, where suicide is the number one cause of death in jails, is that, as you say, they don't know who the people are when they come to them. And so they've had to put into place processes like screening at the front door, screening when they do their medical checkups on people to make sure that they understand how much of a crisis people are in, what kind of coping skills they may have, and the problems that they're bringing with them to the jail environment.
And these codes that involve training of jail staff and face-to-face observation of inmates, these are codes that relate to making sure the psychological components of being jailed are making a safe environment for people. It's not simply about transparency for the officer's behavior, right?
No, that's correct. The professional organizations that have put these standards into place, organizations like the National Council on Correctional Healthcare, the American Psychiatric Association, have recognized that legally it's a duty of jails and prisons to make sure that people's mental and medical health are taken care of while they're under their care.
And thinking about this idea of prison in jail, it seems so counterintuitive to someone who has limited contact with the criminal justice system. You know, if you're innocent, if you're wrongly accused, why would you kill yourself in jail? It seems like that's the thing that someone does when they have no hope, when they're facing a life sentence. But in fact, it's the other way around. Help us to understand why this counterintuitive circumstance is in fact so common.
Well, I think what you said was that it doesn't make sense that people should be hopeless in this situation. But when they encounter a situation that is completely foreign to them, completely out of their experience, they may not understand exactly what their options are, and they may have feelings of being trapped. And when you are put into a jail cell and the routines are very regimented, you can't walk out of the room. You have very limited belongings with you. People can become very desperate, and their mental state can deteriorate over time, particularly if they're not sure what's going to happen, if the response that they had expected from their families or friends didn't materialize as they had anticipated. And so people can find themselves in very desperate straits. And basically, suicide can happen because people see no other way out of the situation. For someone who may have had a history of thinking of suicide or even attempted sometime in the past, it may be something that their mind gravitates to.
Given some of what you described, do you think everyone who comes into a jail is a potential candidate for a suicide watch?
No, not necessarily. It's up to the jail in part to collect the information that's necessary to make these sorts of decisions. Research suggests that in the American public that about 13% of people have had serious suicidal thoughts sometimes in their lives, but that doesn't mean that they're going to go on to commit suicide. Suicide remains a very rare event, even in jails and prisons.
Do you think, based on what you've observed and learned from public sources, that the case of Sandra Bland suggested that she should have been on a suicide watch?
That's really hard for me to say, John. The information that I've seen simply is the screening forms that they used, which they used 3 days before her death, in which she did indicate that she had taken some pills as a suicide attempt. They should have procedures in place to make those kinds of decisions about whether to put people on a heightened level of observation, yes.
Stepping away from the clinical sort of realm here, do you have just a general reaction to this whole frustrating, puzzling case?
Well, I think it, you know, suicide is a very tragic event, no matter where it happens. And when it happens in jail and it happens with someone who is seemingly on the verge of beginning a career and a life on her own, it's always very sad. And it must be completely inexplicable to the people who knew her, as just the brief reports I've seen. Prisons and jails have reduced the numbers of suicides over the last 30 years, but there really is more work to be done.
Robert Canning is a senior psychologist with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation and an expert on suicide prevention in prisons. Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
The banks in Greece have reopened for the first time in 3 weeks, but with restrictions on withdrawals for cash-strapped customers. The country received a short-term loan to pay back the $6.5 billion it owed to the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank. And earlier today, the Greek parliament passed a second crucial set of reforms that's one step closer to negotiating a third bailout package worth $94 billion. Greece's financial woes are far from over, but has the Eurozone system passed some important test? David O'Sullivan, the EU ambassador to the United States, says yes, with some caution.
I think once again we have shown that a little bit as Winston Churchill once said of the Americans, you can rely on them to do the right thing, but only after they've tried all the alternatives. In a slightly messy decision-making process, we arrived at a solid conclusion and a path forward for Greece and its relationship with the Eurozone.
Although many have argued that what you're basically dealing with is, in American history, the Articles of Confederation, where a lack of a strong authority in the EU is causing it to have these crises again and again. And eventually you have to deal with that, as the U.S. did, and created a federal constitution with political authority all down the line.
Well, the European Union is very much a work in progress, and it has many of the features of a federal state, but is still ultimately a group of 28 sovereign countries with 28 parliaments, 28 democracies. And I think the important thing is to be able to make that work. It is clear that there is a limit to what a single country can decide on its own. And Greece elected a government which wanted, if possible, to end austerity. They had a referendum to reject certain bailout terms. But at the end of the day, that has to be reconciled with the democratically elected governments of the other 18 countries.
But doesn't Article 10 of the European Treaty say the functioning of the Union shall be founded on representative democracy? And what you're saying, there are limits to representative democracy. And we're seeing that in the vote of the Greeks was very much against exactly the deal that was approved. So there is a limit to representative democracy here.
Absolutely not. You cannot say that one democracy is more important than another. And at the end of the day, the decisions taken in Brussels have to be validated in our parliament. So not only did the Greek parliament vote to approve the decisions, but all of the other creditor countries also had votes in their parliament. So this is a thoroughly democratic process.
What do you say to the argument of some economists in the United States that Greece is now a puppet state of the EU?
Of course not. This is nonsense. Greece remains a country with its own sovereign democracy, but of course, and it always has choices. But the fact is that the vast bulk of the Greek people wanted to remain within the Eurozone. This was acknowledged by the Prime Minister himself when he admitted that even though the referendum had rejected some of the bailout terms, it was not a referendum giving the government a mandate to leave the euro. And this was the circle that then the government had to square, and that is why I think the Prime Minister has courageously accepted that he will have to agree to some of the bailout terms that he previously rejected in order to respect the democratic wishes of the Greek people to remain part of the euro.
10 years from now, how do you think leaders such as yourself and observers of the European experiment, as some have called it, will look back on this period?
Well, I think it has been a testing period. You should not forget that in 2008, with the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the financial crisis generated here in the United States, which then crossed the Atlantic and created a similar difficult situation in Europe, there were flaws in the architectural design of economic and monetary union which were exposed. It took us some time to repair those. And I think we are now seeing a very solid recovery in all of Europe. I don't disagree that we will need to continue to reflect as to how much further integration in Europe is needed in order to accompany our ambitions on the economic and political front. But this is a process which has been going on since the European Union was created. And I think we will look back on this as a moment of crisis, which was well managed and from which we emerged stronger with greater impetus towards integration.
David O'Sullivan is the EU ambassador to the United States. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Ambassador, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Who can resist hauling out what remains of that old classics education to impress your friends when you speak of the Greek financial crisis? I know I haven't been able to, and I'm not the only one.
This is where civilization started. It's Greece. We're talking about the inventors of math, philosophy, lesbians, the inventors of thick, unswallowable yogurt, the inventors of something that looks like a pie yet is filled with spinach. The Greeks can make this work.
But the Greeks maybe know better about all this, and a lot has happened since the Acropolis became those touristy marble ruins on the hill in Athens. New Yorker writer Daniel Mendelsohn says the Greeks themselves find classical history to be more of an irrelevant burden. As much fun as it may be to say Thucydides, it's the much later stuff, Mendelsohn says, that sheds far more light on what's going on in Greece in 2015.
It's a sort of a cheap journalistic shot to constantly say, oh, well, you know, what's happening in Greece is like what's happened in ancient Greek history. The problem is that they have a lot of history between ancient Greece and modern Greece, which no one ever talks about. So you read, I was just reading the headlines about the Grexit and the Greek crisis, and it's like a tragedy from Euripides, says one paper. It's like a tragedy from Sophocles, says another paper. So, of course, it's fun to show off, but it's not useful.
The classical period was a few hundred years at best, and this presumably irrelevant period that took place between the classical period and today is how many centuries?
Yeah, it's 22 centuries.
You're right, exactly. You know?
It's like, look, it's like if you were trying to write an article about something that's happening in the United States, and all you could ever mention was Benjamin Franklin, and you want to say, well, a lot happened since Benjamin Franklin, but nobody wants to talk about that. And that's how the sort of Greeks feel about constantly being beaten over the head with these classical references.
And if you look at the Greek media, they're using those references much more readily than they are focusing on the classical stuff.
Yes, sure, because they know their own history. You know, the writer that they are referencing right now is not Thucydides or Herodotus, but a poet, a 19th, early 20th century Greek poet called Cavafy, who actually wrote a lot of his poems about later Greek history and these sort of ironic, sardonic poems about failures in Greek history.
What is the tone of these other references, and how do they illuminate what's going on in the souls of Greek citizens right now?
When you invoke the glories of classical Athens, it's a kind of a high picture of what Greece was, but there's a lot of complicated history since then, and what Cavafy's poems always emphasize is sort of how politicians can be deluded by false hopes, how whatever the general's plan was somehow gets screwed up on the day of the battle. You know, those are the things that he's interested in. And of course, right now in Greece, given the really devastating nature of what's happening to the Greek people and the Greek economy, that makes much more sense for them as a reference than to say, oh, the glories of Periclean Athens.
I love this reference to the ability or the capacity to say no.
Yeah.
In the poem that you write about, and how it speaks almost directly to just what happened yesterday.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a famous poem by Cavafy in which he talks about how one day you're going to have to decide to say either yes or no. And of course, a lot of people were quoting that poem right during the referendum. The word no has a very powerful force in modern Greek history. You know, the Greeks asserted themselves at the beginning of World War II in a very famous instance by declaring no in the face of what was going on. And so, you know, if you know a little more about what's happening in modern Greek history, some of these things, like the recent no vote, was not just a no vote, but it was an invocation of a previous stance that they took very bravely.
And it certainly deepens one's understanding of the emotional connection to what's going on now to relate that no to fascism with a very different kind of financial no to a Germany of the 21st century.
Right. But of course, when in 1940 they said no to fascism, they connected in their own recent cultural history to saying no to the Germans in 2015, who they feel are trying to impose another kind of sort of tyranny.
Daniel Mendelsohn, thanks so much.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Daniel Mendelsohn is a writer for The New Yorker.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. Lumosity. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Alzheimer's and the various other manifestations of dementia are quickly becoming the most serious and widespread public health problem in the United States. To the population of 5 million people with Alzheimer's, add 15 million family members and caregivers whose lives are profoundly disrupted by the consequences of the disease. Then add the untold millions of people who fear getting Alzheimer's and watch for signs, pay attention to every medical development, seek out the results of every experimental drug test. In these times, millions and millions of people each year pay attention to what comes out of the annual Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Washington. And the well-timed headline from the marketers at drugmaker Eli Lilly this time around say very preliminary data suggest a new drug might be able to slow down the onset of Alzheimer's by slowing the development of what's called amyloid plaque buildup in the brain. Joining us now, Dr. David Kramer, a retired emergency physician who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease in 2012. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you.
And Meryl Comer is with us. She's been an Alzheimer's caregiver for 20 years. Her husband, a former research physician at the National Institutes of Health, was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 57. Meryl cares for him at home, along with her mother, who also has the disease. Meryl, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Now, to both of you, and just giving kind of a yes or no here, you follow this stuff, like, every detail, right?
Passionately, yeah.
Exactly. I can hear it. Dr. Kramer, what's your reaction to the Eli Lilly preliminary results here? Is it a hope? Is it a caution? Is it a here we go again?
Well, it's all of the above. I will have some preliminary optimism with the results, but I had the opportunity to read the paper on the study that was discussed and presented yesterday. And the data is very, very preliminary. And there is not any clear evidence from what I've been able to see that this is going to have a long-term effect. But it is way too soon to tell.
And Meryl, how do you deal with these way too soon to tell but positive details?
Well, I'm neither a scientist nor a neurologist, but I've been at the bedside, as you said, for 20 years. So I'm looking at the hope, because what I see is that it's promising but premature, and people tend to read the headlines only. So we'll receive calls and saying, good news, your problems are over. Well, they don't understand the complexity of the disease. It's easier to get to Mars than find a disease-modifying therapy for a very complex issue like Alzheimer's. What's exciting to me is that the companies, we need to applaud the companies like Lilly and Biogen and Roche and Merck that are staying in the game. You know, we went through a phase where after these failed trials, we were afraid that we would be abandoned at a time when the numbers are growing exponentially, 44 million globally, you know, suffering with the disease. So I stay close to the science, as do all advocates, because we are desperate. Give us 5 more years of quality of life, John, and think what that might mean to an individual.
What's it like to get that diagnosis, David? And is it a powerlessness you feel knowing that there's some sort of time out there where your life is going to fundamentally change, even as you fight for quality right now?
I do not feel powerless. I feel that it's important for me to enjoy the time that I have now. My wife and I focus on doing everything that we can now and enjoying life. There is a definite benefit in having an early diagnosis, as I was fortunate to have, in that I can then say, all right, I know what I've got, but I'm doing well now. And as long as I can continue to do well and live well with the disease, I plan on doing that.
Out of the latest Alzheimer's facts and figures, 50% of doctors refuse to diagnose because they have nothing to offer their patients, and they don't want to depress them. But You know, when you hear that the quality of life you're grabbing for as long as you can have it is important, let the families decide. Give us the diagnosis. Don't be paternalistic about what we can manage. My husband was misdiagnosed for 4 years, a depression, Lyme's disease, you know, go take a vacation. It's insulting to families, and we're lost and confounded by behaviors because behaviors are the first things that appear. So I think it's very incumbent that we have to say early diagnosis, give us a chance to live the moment with our loved ones. Don't decide for us.
I agree.
Meryl, it seems to me, and maybe I'm just being ghoulish here, but that if you're grasping for a quality of life, you're essentially trying to collect memories that you know are going to vanish on some level. That just seems so poignant. How does that work actually in the way that you interact with your family members and loved ones?
You try to live in the moment. Much easier said than done. Often you're moving from crisis to crisis. You have to go with the disease. I mean, my husband became the stranger. The caregiver actually forgets who they are because you are so focused on protecting the dignity of a loved one who has the disease, of giving them their last hurrah. That takes tremendous energy. And what we're learning is the caregivers are getting sick.
John, I'd like to emphasize, I'm much more concerned about the impact of this disease on my wife than I am of the impact on myself. So that is absolutely key, and I totally agree with Meryl regarding that. I did want to mention real quickly that I think there are a lot of closeted people with dementia because they're embarrassed, because they might not have the financial means. They might be afraid of losing their friends. They might be afraid of losing their jobs, which they cannot afford to, and so forth. And since so many people are in denial and other factors, I actually believe that the true number of people with early onset is a lot higher than currently reported.
David, before we go, I have this idea of you, you know, organizing your life around quality and being in the moment, David, of, you know, you climbing some summit and staring out and wanting somehow, knowing that memory might go away, trying to sort of glue it more firmly inside your skull somehow. Yes, you're worried about your wife, but what does it feel like to be acquiring memories that you know will fade long before you actually leave the planet?
Oh, boy. It's not something that I worry about on a day-to-day basis, to be perfectly honest.
Glad to hear it.
I'll be totally honest with you, and my wife and I laugh at a lot of the things that happen. I'll tell her the same story time and time again, and she always says that I say it in the same way with the same sense of humor. She says it's still Dave. So, you know, we just try to take the best light and look at things in the best way that we possibly can and enjoy the day-to-day life that we have.
Meryl Comer and Dr. David Kramer, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
It was a pleasure.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Meryl Comer is an Alzheimer's caregiver and author of Slow Dancing with a Stranger, about her husband's early onset diagnosis, the proceeds of which all go to Alzheimer's research. She also cares for her mother, who has the disease, and is co-founder of Women Against Alzheimer's. Dr. David Kramer is a retired emergency room physician who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease in 2012. To hear an extended version of this conversation, visit thetakeaway.org. That's all for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. And Curious.com, helping people grow skills in areas like programming and parenting, broadcasting a live discussion on how to raise an adult this Thursday with author Julie Lithcott-Hames at 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.